The Next Life, written by SPQR and read by K-Verb. This is a BatFam fic, rated teen and up audiences, in which no archive warnings apply. It features the relationships between Tim and Jason, Tim and Bruce, Tim and Dick, and Constantine and Tim. Relevant tags include Necromancer Tim Drake, Hurt / Comfort, Bruce is a good parent, and warnings for graphic descriptions of corpses, nightmares, and underage drinking.
When you can't win for losing, and the beggars start choosing the chaos in your head, calls the cracks to start showing, all knowing, all glowing with the light of the dying.
As soon as Tim figures out necromancy is real, he knows he's going to do something stupid. It's 2:15 on a Tuesday afternoon. Technically, Tim should be in fifth period history, suffering under the tender mercies of Mrs. Halberstam, but Robin's been dead for a week, and he doesn't have the energy for school. He might not have known Jason personally, but it feels like he did. Like all those nights following him and Batman around Gotham, those friendly smiles exchanged in the halls at school, and that one time Tim got caught playing an involuntary game of Monkey in the Middle with two 10th grade meatheads and his $10,000 camera, and Jason stepped in to rescue him, all amounted to something like a real friendship. He knows, logically, that it's not true, that it's just some parasocial whatever, but he still feels like he's in mourning. The world feels darker. Last night, Batman almost beat a man to death, and all Tim could do was stand on that rooftop in the miserable, pissing rain, holding his camera in numb fingers and watch, his stomach like a brick, tugging his heart towards the ground. But now it's 2:15 on a Tuesday, and 7:15 in London, where apparently the British are having a minor zombie apocalypse.
"Every graveyard and mausoleum in the city," reports a harried newscaster,
only half turned to camera while he watches over his shoulder, where the slow, terrifying tide of the dead presses against Scotland Yard's riot shields.
"Estimated nearly 100,000 have risen so far, with many still clawing their way out of the Oh God, they're coming!"
He breaks off and bolts, cameraman hot on his heels as the dead come pouring through a rift in the police phalanx, moaning and rasping and gray wax-like flesh, a blur of milky eyes and a rotted-out mouth, and the feed cuts abruptly back to the studio, where two BBC anchors seem to be in shock, sitting there under the bright fluorescence at a total loss for words. The news coverage is pretty much useless. The news helicopters are making out well enough, but no one on the ground can manage to keep a camera feed going for longer than a few minutes, and most of the information that's being reported is pulled straight from social media, seeing as neither the police, nor the NHS, nor the Crown seem to have any idea what's going on. Tim gives up after about 10 minutes and opens his laptop instead to pull up the JLA's comm feeds. He's got a back door into the Batcave computer, which he normally doesn't use because it feels impolite, but in this particular instance, he thinks it's warranted. The coffee table is a mess of cold mugs. Tim's eyes are red and overtired from crying and lack of sleep, and his pantry's almost empty. If this thing's going to spread across the pond, then there's going to be a rush on the grocery stores, and he wants to get out ahead of it. Bewilderingly, the only thing the Justice League is doing is having a pub crawl. They're looking, Tim gathers, for someone called Constantine. First name Deadbeat, according to the Green Lantern. Jerkwad, according to the Flash. And John, according to Superman, who they think is probably too busy drinking himself into a stupor.
"As fucking usual," the Lantern cuts in,
to have noticed the world ending outside. They're right. It's Black Canary who finds him, passed out behind the bar at a deserted club in Soho, a bottle of scotch in each hand and a pool of drool congealing under his face, snoring obliviously through the wall of air raid sirens that haven't been used since the Second World War. Dinah has to scream to wake him up. It shatters all the glass in the place, including the bottle in Constantine's hand, but it does the trick. The man comes awake with a lurch, swearing a streak blue enough to make Superman mutter,
"Oh, jeez."
And somehow in the space of 15 minutes, the entire outbreak is under control. The news that Tim's got muted in the background doesn't cover any of it, of course. They'd have to know what was happening to do that. But from what Tim can tell through the comms, all Constantine does is stagger over to the closet Leyline Convergence, dark sunglasses shoved on his face, stopping once or twice to puke in a shrub, and recite in a very annoyed tone of voice some dusty old Latin, which translates roughly to,
"Go back to sleep, motherfuckers."
Tim's familiar enough with fantasy tropes that he knows there are a few key dangers to raising the dead. First off, there are wrong ways and right ways to do it. People can come back wrong, come back with a body but not a soul, come back with their essences twisted and corrupted by the memory of having died. Second, when you open a door to the underworld, the dead aren't the only things that can get through. And third, there's always a price. Traditionally exacted in blood. He's got no problem with a third consideration. There's not much he wouldn't do to bring Robin back from the dead, to give Bruce back his son. But in order to avoid the first two, he thinks it's probably prudent to seek out the advice of an expert. And the only necromancer he even knows about is John Constantine. So in lieu of any other options, him figures he'll start there. It's not difficult to get to London, even as an unaccompanied minor. Tim's found throughout the years that most adults trust computers more than they trust their own eyes or intuition. So as long as the airline's records say he's cleared to fly and going to be met at the airport by a parent, no one pays him so much as a second glance. Sure, he has to wear the dumb wristband on the flight, but he pays for a first-class ticket, and no one really gives rich kids much trouble about these sort of things. He spends half the flight reviewing the dossier he's assembled on John Constantine, and the other half in a light doze, divvying in and out of sick, cloying semi-nightmares, flashes of Robin's cape, and Jason sulking at Wayne Foundation galas, Batman's gauntlet slick with blood, and the sound of his own sobs echoing down empty hallways. He comes awake with a spinal jolt as the seatbelt chimes on for landing, head foggy with a bad taste in his mouth. Out the window, the sun is rising over a city that's still recovering from a uniquely hellish night. Once Tim meets up with his hired driver, it takes them 6 hours to travel a distance Raheem informs him would normally take less than one. Half the roads are blocked off by emergency services. They've had to call in the military to help with the cleanup. Only half the dead were substantial enough to make it back to whatever graves they crawled out of. And the city of London is about to have a major biological disaster on their hands if they can't reinter them before the rot sets in again. There are bonfires burning in Trafalgar Square, great pyres churning acrid smoke into the sky, crowds of people, hundreds strong, gathered outside graveyards and churches and morgues, desperate to account for their loved ones. At one point, they come to a cheap hotel that seems to have had some sort of ancient crypt underneath, guests sitting on their suitcases and frantically trying to arrange new accommodations out on the sidewalk, absorbed in their cell phones, while beside them a swarm of CSI types in latex gloves and booties try to make sense of the mess of bones and Roman armor, oxidized green copper coins scattered among detached phalanges. The operation has spilled out into the street, only one lane left passable, and the city doesn't seem to have been able to spare anyone to flag traffic. So it's a nightmarish free-for-all, cars starting and stopping, stomping on brakes and laying on their horns when two of them try to go at once. They're stuck for long enough that Tim hops out of the car to run down the block to a coffee shop and makes it back before Raheem's even gone 3 feet.
"Your parents are in London," Raheem asks, when they've both been sipping their drinks for a while.
A black eye for Tim, green tea for Raheem. The only movement outside the laying on of horns.
"You are meeting them."
"Yeah." Tim's been telling lies to cover up his loneliness since he was 6 years old.
It used to make him nervous. He used to think every adult he talked to would ferret him out and call the authorities. But now he knows most of them don't care enough to look that hard, so he could do it in his sleep. They're archaeologists. This is like a huge event for them. Rahim makes a displeased noise, staring unfocused out the windshield. "My brother died last year," he tells Tam. "I am glad that he was buried in Pakistan. I wouldn't like to think of him like this, disturbed. He did his time. He does not deserve to be woken up." "I'm sorry," Tim's about to say. He's not really sorry, because he didn't do anything. But his mother schooled him well enough in pleasantries that he knows that's what you're supposed to say when someone shows you their grief. But before he can, the clogged bottleneck of traffic loosens up again, suitcases and skeletons shuffling out of the street, and Rahim drives on. By the time Tim finds Constantine, or at least makes it to the shoddy office that serves as his official league address, the sun has gone down. No one answers the door when Tim knocks, except someone down the hall who yells through their own door for him to keep it down. "The bloody dead have already been raised once this week. No need to knock loud enough to do it again." So he sits down on the hall floor and settles in to wait. He could get a hotel. God knows he'd have no trouble affording it. But the idea of closing himself in a strange room in a strange city and trying to sleep doesn't seem appealing. And on top of it feels too much like giving up, which he won't do after he's come all this way. Instead, propped in the shallow dip of Constantine's office door, he pulls his sweatshirt hood up over his greasy hair and hugs his backpack to his front, resolved to stay awake. Sometime later, a sharp kick and a tired, "Oi!" yanks him out of his sleep. Constantine's glowering over him, trench coat dripping with rainwater, blonde hair almost green under the awful fluorescence. "What the bloody fuck are you then?" "Mr. Constantine," Tim scrambles to his feet, smoothing his sweatshirt down like that will do any fucking good when he's just been traveling for about 20 hours. "I'm Tim, sir. Tim Drake, from Gotham."
"Right," Constantine says. "Piss off now, Tim Drake from Gotham."
He shoulders past him to open his office door, muttering under his breath. He's got that flat, sour smell like he's been bathing in troughs of alcohol, and a white-knuckled grip on a soggy bag of Chinese takeaway. And Tim read in his JLA file that he has a bad habit of going down to hell to literally drag people out of it, Satan be damned. So he should probably just piss off and not antagonize the man. But if there is even the slightest chance that Constantine can help Tim get Jason back, then he has to take it. He has to do everything he possibly can. So instead of pissing off, he sticks his foot in the door before Constantine can close it and shoves into the office after him, slipping on a pile of overdue rent notices. Constantine swears. "Oi, what the hell?"
"Listen," Tim says quickly, recovering. "I really need your help."
Constantine puts a palm on his forehead and pushes.
"Well, I've been hungover for 2 days, Sprague. I don't have it in me to perform any exorcisms right now."
"I don't need an exorcism," Tim says, following him into the tiny kitchenette.
"I beg to bloody differ," Constantine mutters.
Nobly, Tim elects to ignore him.
"I want you to teach me."
"Teach you what? Manners?"
"I already know manners," Tim says, then barrels on as Constantine snorts in disagreement. "What I need to learn is necromancy." Constantine braces both hands on the table, hangs his head like a man suffering through a great and Sisyphean ordeal, then takes a deep breath and looks up at Tim again.
"How old are you, Poppet?"
10.
Tim bristles, defensive.
"So what if I am?"
"I can't be teaching a 10-year-old to raise the dead. It's just not responsible. It's not even responsible to teach most adults. I had to learn the hard way, trial by fire and all. It's not like there's an online bloody course."
"I can pay," Tim interrupts. Constantine snorts, returning to the task of unloading cartons and cartons of lo mein, enough to feed maybe 5 or 6 normal people.
I'm not a bloody whore, mate. I'm not putting out for a fucking fiver.
How about 50 grand? Tim says.
Constantine stops. His eyebrows go up and stay there. 75, he says. And I want it up front, in cash.
It's going to take some doing, convincing the bank that he has authorization to withdraw that amount of cash from his trust fund, but Tim's nothing if not creative. Plus, he came in here prepared to go as high as 150, so 75 is basically a steal. Deal, he says, and holds his hand out for Constantine to shake. Constantine stares at it from a beat, like he thinks it might bite him, or like he feels strange accepting $75,000 in cash from a 10-year-old, which Tim figures is fair. Then he reaches out and shakes it. Fucking hell, he says to himself while he does. This is going to bite me in the arse. Tim has always had an analytical, logical mind. Math, coding, criminal investigation, it's always come easy to him. Patterns and numbers fitting into place in his mind like the teeth of a zipper coming together. Neat and tidy and airtight. Magic should be the antithesis of that. It's vague, esoteric, more an art than a science, especially the way Constantine practices it. But the more Tim learns, the more time he spends with his nose buried in grimoires and mildewy old tomes written entirely in 5th century church Latin, and the incongruous collection of files that someone for some reason decided back in the 60s needed to be stored on microfilm, which he has to carry all the way down to the Guildhall library to even look at, the more he starts to see that there are patterns. There is a sort of science underneath it all. The only issue is that no one's ever bothered to express it in clear mathematics. What are you? Writing in bloody code now, Constantine mutters, paging through Tim's notebook over dinner at the pub. Tim's been in London a month, and they eat at the same pub pretty much 3 meals a day. The tab under Tim's name must be almost £2,000 at this point. I told you, this stuff can't be reduced to feckin' numbers. Then how come I can reduce it to fecking numbers? Tim asks, innocent. Constantine scowls and shoves his notebook back across the table. Look, the problem with thinking you can quantify it is that you're going to expect the same results every time. But you're never going to get the same result, not even twice. But you have to, Tim points out. Otherwise, how do you know anything? Or are you telling me you're just taking random shots in the dark? Shut it with the disrespect. Constantine jabs a forkful of shepherd's pie at him. It's a negotiation, Sprague, not a bloody one for one. When you want something, you want to get into hell, talk to someone in heaven, or drive a high-order demon out of a nun, you're making a deal with something sentient. Not always something sane, right? But always something sentient. You can't predict that. You can do your own research, you can rely on past experience, but you can't know for sure. You can never know. For sure. Just like with people. Fine, Tim says. Whatever you say, Mr. Constantine, sir.
Constantine flicks pie at him. Still, though, prowling behind Constantine as he roves through the city of London, Tim manages to suss out several inalienable laws of magic. 1. All magic costs something. A psychopomp, living in the storm drains that feed into the Thames, charges 71 human teeth to ferry lost souls into the realm of the dead. Constantine slits his palm and squeezes blood onto a cold blue body at the morgue, muttering borrowed life to bring a murdered woman back long enough to identify her killer, mute from a broken jaw, but able to point well enough. Summoning a low-order demon requires an offering of dirty magazines, lubriderm, and flaming hot Cheetos. 2. Magic can't disobey the laws of physics. Energy has to come from somewhere. Matter can neither be created nor destroyed. And even when Constantine uses arcane blood magic to temporarily stop time, like he does when they lose track of a particularly slippery vampire inside a children's hospital, he's really just stopping their perception of time.
When the freeze is over and the rain starts falling again outside, Tim watches the time on his phone jump forward to match up with the rest of the universe. And not for a single second does the Earth stop turning, which is good, because if it did, everyone on it would be dead. 3. The degree of magic must match the skill of the user. If Tim tried to, say, call in a high-order demon, then the summoning spell would get away from him, like an unbroken stallion getting away from a novice rider, and the demon would have total control over itself and over Tim. Constantine impresses this upon him many times. "You try and run before you can walk, Poppet. All you're going to do is get people killed, and their blood will be on your hands." 4. Do as Constantine does, not as Constantine says. There are a number of lessons passed from the sorcerer to apprentice, which Constantine goes on to prove patently false immediately, or at least soon after uttering. For example, never conduct an exorcism in a moving vehicle. Don't antagonize angels, especially not Gabriel. Don't induce visions while inebriated. Never use a tabby cat in a ritual. Never cast blood magic during a full moon. Don't ever back out of a spell once you've started it. And don't smoke, Sprague. Christ, those things will kill you. 5. Not everyone can practice magic. According to Constantine, it's easier if you start as a kid, like learning a foreign language, or chess, or advanced math. The earlier you begin, the more malleable your brain is, the better chance you have of grasping the strange, unnatural arithmetic of the occult. So we're lucky you're still a fetus, eh? 6. Magic, once done, can never be undone. There are patches you can apply, fixes you can attempt, but once you use magic to change something, you've altered its very essence, and you can never, ever go back to the way it was before. Most of what Constantine tells him, Tim takes with a grain of salt. Not ironically, including the strong suggestion that he salts his windows every night before bed, which Tim does religiously, even though he knows he's probably freaking the cleaning ladies at the Bentley out. Constantine's rules on necromancy, though, he takes as gospel. He can't afford to make a mistake, bringing Jason back. He only has one chance to do it, and he has to do it perfectly, or else Batman and Robin will both be lost forever. Constantine leaves London twice to work with the JLA while Tim's under his tutelage. Once to, quote-unquote, vanquish someone called Veronica Delacroix, who apparently used to be Constantine's friend, but now is some sort of soul-eating demon terrorizing the city of New York. After which Constantine comes back sullen and uncommunicative and throws a bottle at Tim's head when he tries to ask what's wrong. And wants to cast an illusion over the entire planet and trick Darkseid into thinking it was already dead. A feat so incredibly draining that he spends the next 8 days mostly asleep, waking only to shovel food from the pub downstairs into his mouth, burp and shit, and go back to sleep. "Who's the fetus now?" Tim grumbles, turning Constantine onto his side so he doesn't drown in his own puke or whatever. But he's the only one there to laugh at his joke, so it falls kind of flat. As far as Gotham Academy is concerned, Tim's being tutored at his parents' dig site outside La Paz. He created a fake identity for a woman called Miss Sweetwater, complete with a work history, which includes teaching English to a non-existent prince of Saudi Arabia, who dutifully emails documentation of his progress every other Friday at 3 p.m. Bolivia time. But his parents aren't in on the con, so when they call to let him know that they're going to be home for 3 days in May, Tim has to scramble. When Tim tells him he has to go, Constantine's perplexed. "I thought your parents were dead," he says. Tim frowns over his pint of beer, which is a quarter full. Constantine only ever lets him have half a pint because, in his words, him weighs about equal to a feather soaking wet. "No, they're not dead. Why did you think that?" "I don't know," Constantine says flatly. "Maybe because you're a 10-year-old living alone in a hotel halfway around the bloody world from home, paying me to teach you how to raise the dead. Why the hell are you here if that's not it?"
Well, Tim says, and then has to stop himself from saying, you know Batman, right? He might be a lightweight, but he's only had a quarter of a pint, and he's not stupid. Constantine probably wouldn't be happy to discover he's teaching a total stranger how to bring Batman's dead son back to life. And from what Tim's heard about other magic users, he's pretty sure he snagged himself the most civilized one. He doesn't want to have to switch mentors now. So instead, he says, I had a friend. He was my hero. He was a lot of people's hero, actually. And he died. He was only 16. I think he deserves more time than that.
A lot of people deserve more time than that, Constantine says darkly.
He gets a cigarette from his coat pocket and lights it, fingers so fast they're almost clumsy. Like he needs it now, or something's going to come out of him. Something's going to break.
Not many get it.
Jason's going to get it, Tim says, stubborn. I'm going to give it to him. Constantine stares at him for a long moment through the haze of cigarette smoke, eyes tight at the edges, between his eyebrows, like they get when he's trying to work his way through a particularly sticky problem.
Aye, he says, at last. I reckon you are, Sprague. I just hope you don't have to give up too much to do it.
Tim spends 3 days in Gotham with his parents. He puts on his uniform every morning and makes a show of walking to the bus, which he takes into the city just to putz around for the rest of the day, catching up on new local developments. Polly's hot dog cart has moved from the corner of 5th to the corner of 6th. Better real estate, prime real estate, Polly says when he sees Tim, recognizes him, asks him where he's been hiding. I'm making 100 extra bucks a day, selling to those rich lawyer types coming out of the courthouse. Captain Gordon is now Commissioner Gordon, a promotion which pretty much everyone agrees was well-deserved. There's a new photography exhibit at the art museum, which Tim has to hightail it out of after the docent starts giving him a look like he knows Tim's playing hooky, and a new construction site in the financial district, some sort of shiny new LexCorp building going up next to Wayne Tower, which Lois Lane from Metropolis's Daily Planet already suspects is being built for the purposes of corporate espionage. In characteristic fashion, his parents pay him no attention. They're almost completely absorbed in the unpacking and repacking of their bags, replacing the desert linens they needed in Morocco for the heavier knits and canvas pants they're taking to Norway. And what time isn't spent conducting legions of servants around the halls of Drake Manor is dedicated to attending various galas and soirees and putting in FaceTime at the corporate offices to remind the board that they exist. When they are home, they carry on conversations that seem specifically designed to fly over Tim's head, ironing out logistics for the Norway dig and reminiscing over things he wasn't a part of.
Oh, remember that dodgy old professor we met in Cairo? What was his name?
Or, remember that Christmas we spent in Tahiti before Tim was born? That was so lovely, so peaceful with just the two of us. We should do it again.
Tim minds less than he used to. He's become numb to it over the years. And besides, he's got other things on his mind, namely the bats. He's been doing his best to check in on them remotely, but it's not the same. He has to see them. From the tree at the border of their properties, with his binoculars, Tim can see a few lights on in Wayne Manor. Just 3. And from his unauthorized wanderings during Wayne Foundation galas of years past, he thinks they're in Bruce's study, the kitchen, and Alfred's room. There's a silhouette in the study, dark behind drawn curtains.
Bruce,
Tim thinks with a lurch, though he can't make out any details. He knows the set of Bruce's shoulders, the beleaguered way he lowers himself into the chair behind the desk, like every muscle in his body hurts, dropping his head in his hands like he can't keep it up anymore, like it's all too heavy. Tim wasn't at the funeral. As far as he could ever figure out, no one was. Not even Dick Grayson. But he thinks that the Bruce he's looking at now is still the mourner, still stood at his son's graveside under driving rain, hands closed in tight fists at his sides, every tendon and ligament in his body pulled tight under the taut strain of impotent agony. Bruce hasn't moved on, hasn't even moved an inch. Tim swallows a thick swell of nauseous, feverish guilt. He should be moving faster,
He should have had Jason back by now. Every second he wastes is causing Batman pain, and reminds himself that this isn't something he can rush. If he brings Jason back wrong, that's it. It can be undone. He has to do it right. Later that night, back on the streets of his city, running across rooftops after Batman with his camera, Tim feels more like coming home than he did walking through the front door of Drake Manor. After a while, he realizes he's smiling, more baring his teeth than anything, but it feels like exhilaration, like wind, flying between fire escapes, spotting the ghost-like flash of Batman's cape around corners, hearing the rumble of the Batmobile, and the familiar rhythms of fistfights down pitch-black alleys. So much of what Tim's been doing lately has dealt with the dead, with the next life, that it's refreshing to finally feel again like he's living in this one. Eventually, Nightwing joins the proceedings, Batwoman in tow as a mediator. They stop to confer over something, papers spread out in the hood of the Batmobile. A case, probably, something that involves Bloodhaven as well as Gotham, but Tim's too far away to make out what they're saying. It doesn't matter. He finds a rooftop across the street and settles in to watch them through the lens of his camera, relaxing into their familiar gestures, familiar stone-faced expressions. Barbara's red hair frizzing with sticky spring humidity, Dick's arms crossed tightly over his chest, posture closed off. Bruce rolls up the papers and starts to turn away. Barbara nudges Dick with her elbow, and Dick reaches out to Bruce to stop him, extending an olive branch, opening his expression with some obvious difficulty, only for Bruce to shove him off, never even turning. Tim's mood crashes back to earth like a stone. He follows Batman for the rest of the patrol, watches him beat a low-level dealer so close to death that Tim can almost feel him, the way he can walk into a room now and feel when someone's died in it. When he finally gets back to Drake Manor an hour or so before dawn, he pulls the lockbox out from under his bed, punches in the combination, the first day he ever saw Jason Todd as Robin, and pulls out his old photos. Robin elbowing Batman with a huge, impish smile on his face, Batman's lips pressed tight in something that's almost a grudging grin. Robin as a blur of motion, red and yellow and green, leaping into battle. Batman on his knees, his thumb pressed to Robin's chin, examining a split lip. Sometimes Tim used to wonder if he was taking pictures of his heroes or just taking pictures of a happy family. Now, looking over the photos he took tonight, the answer is pretty clear. He's not taking pictures of Batman anymore. Just a man who's been completely cut in half by loss. Constantine bakes a cake for Tim's 11th birthday, which he swears up and down is gingerbread, but tastes like eating a rock with some dirt still stuck on it. Tim blows out a singular candle, seconds Constantine's decision to dump the cake in the trash after the first bite, puts down an entire pint of Guinness, just because it's a special occasion, Constantine warns him, and then demands he be allowed to talk to a dead person as his birthday present. Morbid much? Constantine drawls, but he's grinning, and he's had several pints of Guinness himself, plus some scotch besides, so he acquiesces readily enough. They won't be speaking the bard's English, he cautions Tim, while they're loitering outside the back door of the city morgue, waiting for Constantine's morally ambiguous friend Irina to sneak them in. If we're lucky, they'll be speaking one of the dialects of hell. If we're not, your eardrums might burst. What? Tim asks, tipsy and slightly alarmed. Don't worry about it, Sprague, Constantine says, jostling him as Irina shoves open the door and waves to them impatiently. Hardly anyone goes to heaven. Chances are good you'll go your whole life without hearing the angelic tongue.
That's depressing, Tim mutters.
Constantine snorts as he herds him into the morgue. Best get used to it. In our line of work, there isn't much that isn't. The corpse comes back to life spitting and thrashing,
frozen throat and gnashing teeth, rasping out one of the dialects of the damned. Constantine seizes the man by the jaw, forces his mouth open, and hawks a loogie right in there. Tim's been warned already that this is the fastest way to bestow human language back on the dead, but it's still disgusting. He wrinkles his nose while he wraps up the cut on his hand, standing on a chair next to the slab.
"Go on, then," Constantine prods,
when the corpse's rasping starts to sound like English, garbled through the filter of a thick Northern Irish accent.
"Ask him what you want to ask him, birthday boy."
Tim glances back at Irina, who's leaning against the wall by the door examining her acrylics, totally disinterested in anything but the 20 quid Constantine's going to owe her for tonight. He should ask her who this guy is, probably, in case he's a murder victim or a predator or something. Maybe there's something useful Tim can try and get out of him, something that would help someone still alive. But Tim's selfish, and he's homesick for someone he barely even talked to while they were alive, someone who might now be gone forever. So he asks, "Do you remember who you were before?" There's no reply, not one that makes any sense anyway. The corpse babbles, throwing itself around on top of the metal table, its voice like two knives clashing together, even with the gift of human language.
"Tim,"
Constantine says, voice low, then swears and snatches him down off the chair before the corpse can kick it over. He sets Tim behind him, then lunges forward and seizes the corpse by the head again, this time so that he can turn one of his rings around and press it to his forehead, hissing out a terse stream of Latin. The corpse writhes, struggling beneath the ring like it's an enormous weight, then drops back limp against the slab. The silence that follows is freezing cold. Tim stands with his arms wrapped around himself, the cut on his palm stinging, trying and failing not to shake like a leaf. He's just a kid, he realizes suddenly, the severity of what he's doing catching up with him all at once. Constantine gives him a long look, like he's remembering the same thing. Then he glances back at Irina, who raises one judgmental eyebrow, still tip-tapping at her acrylics, hangs his head and says,
"All right then, Sprog, you're crashing with me tonight."
Tim shaking too hard to even nod. Constantine, to his credit, and possibly because he has no idea how to deal with children, doesn't coddle Tim at all. Not in the cab on the way back to the office, and not once they're inside. He tosses a wad of blankets on the couch, pours out a few fingers of scotch in Tim's favorite mug, for the nightmares, and leaves the light on in the bathroom when he shuffles into the back room to collapse on his old droopy cot. Tim burrows down under the blankets, wrapping himself like a swaddled baby, but he still feels cold. He's used to that feeling, the loneliness, how you can sometimes feel it on your skin, numbing parts of your soul, but this is different. When he closes his eyes, he feels like he is that corpse, like he drowned in the murky brown waters of the Thames and came up blue and bloated and got yanked back to life in the alien, artificial cold of a morgue freezer, harsh green fluorescence screaming down into the darkness. The Waynes, Tim makes himself think. Warm lights in the manor windows. Jason ruffling his hair at school after he saved his camera from those meatheads. Batman pulling rescued kids out of a school bus the Joker was planning to use in one of his stunts, passing tiny kindergartners down into the arms of waiting social workers. The indulgent little smile Tim had caught on camera as one of them pawed at the ears of his cowl. Dick and Jason at a gala, shiny and regal in tuxes. Jason scowling and Dick clapping him on the shoulder, steering him out into the fray. Tim had been in the corner, cramming hors d'oeuvres in his face to try and appease the gnawing in his stomach, before his mom found him again and forced him to serve as a prop while she talked to stuffy old investors. But for a moment, Jason had spotted him across the room and given him a look like Tim was in on the joke of how awful the gala was, how much they were being tortured, being forced to be here, how they'd both probably rather be suffering in Mrs. Halberstam's class than here. And for a moment, Tim had felt like someone lit a candle in his chest. Not a strong light, and not much warmth, but enough to get him through. He searches for that feeling again here, on Constantine's couch, and while he's searching, drops into a fitful sleep. In the morning, Constantine wakes him by clattering around the kitchenette and loudly trying to make a pot of coffee, which if Tim had to guess, he'd say he's doing on purpose, because he doesn't know how to work the coffee maker. He doesn't bother detangling from his blankets, just rolls off the couch and shuffles over to push the right buttons and jam the filter in, then deposits himself at the table. So, he starts, once they're both installed with their coffees. Constantine's spike, Tim's not, since he wants clarity of mind for this conversation. It's been a few months. I think it's fair to say I've gotten a pretty good grasp of the basics. The basics, Constantine echoes, voice the same shade of exhausted as the bags under his eyes. Of magic, Tim clarifies. The occult. I've taken extensive notes. I've observed your work. I've done some work of my own. I think it's time we get down to brass tacks. And what tacks would those be? The ones concerned with bringing someone back to life, Tim says. And I don't mean what we did at the morgue last night, or what happened in February with the zombies. I mean permanently back to life, the way they were before. Your friend, Constantine clarifies. This Jason fellow. Tim nods. Constantine squints at him for a long moment, the way he's always squinting at Tim, like he's trying to parse something. If I don't teach you, you're just going to look for the bloody Book of the Dead or something, aren't you? Muck it all up and make a mess I'll just have to clean up anyways. Probably, Tim says. Plus, I'll sue you for breach of contract. I never signed a contract. Tim produces his phone and shows Constantine a photo of the pub napkin he scribbled the contract on before he handed over $75,000 in cash, complete with the detective's signature. Constantine sighs. This is why you don't have any friends, mate. Fine, get up. We're going to the archives. What Constantine refers to as the archives is really just a storage locker in the south of London, crammed from floor to ceiling with newspaper clippings about Jack the Ripper traveling through time, and mysterious fleshy bits and jars and other occult items. Constantine retrieves a three-ring binder that's seen better days, plops it down on the card table that's wedged in the back corner, and says, Right, most of what I've learned in this area, I've learned through trial and error. So listen closely, because error is not pretty. Okay, Tim sits up straight, completely focused on the most important lesson he's ever been taught. Okay, I'm listening.
Necromancy,
Constantine reminded Tim, in that storage unit all those years ago,
is about negotiation.
The thing about being 11, Tim thinks in hindsight, is that everything is out of proportion. Things that should be scary don't scare you. A B+ in Mrs. Halberstam's history class is the end of the world, and you will literally die if you don't get to see the new Star Wars movie on opening night. 11-year-olds shouldn't be allowed to handle life or death negotiations, because the farthest they can think into the future is about 3 months. Which is not to say that Tim regrets the deal he made. He hasn't regretted it for a single second. Not when Jason gasped back to life with glowing green eyes. Not when he pummeled him and left him choking in his own blood in the mud in that graveyard. Not when Red Hood started shooting his way through Gotham and Tim had to offer himself up as Robin anyways. Tim might not have stuck the landing, per se, but Jason Todd is alive, and that's worth a hell of a lot more than 5 years of Tim's life. It doesn't matter that Jason hates him, or that he barely ever comes back to the manor, even when Alfred invites him to dinner, or that Bruce still gets that sad, pinched look whenever he comes up in conversation, the one he tries to hide from Tim and Dick, but which they both totally know him too well to miss. Batman doesn't beat people half to death anymore, and him and Dick are actually on speaking terms. Good speaking terms. And sometimes Red Hood even helps out when they catch a case in his territory. For the Waynes, Tim would give a whole lot more than a measly half a decade. Of course, Constantine had also warned him that he should never, ever accept a deal with the devil at face value. He's on patrol when the first hit comes, a glancing blow to the head that smacks him hard against a brick wall, hanging from his grapple. His grip on the wire is good, anchored to his utility belt, but the tug on his shoulder still hurts like a son of a bitch, and he hisses.
"Robin, report."
Batman's voice comes over the comms. Tim presses his fingers into his throbbing temple. They come away bloody. "I'm fine," he says. It's true enough. He's hanging like a sack of laundry from the grapple, turning slowly with his cape heavy around his shoulders, but at least he didn't hit the ground. "Something got me in the head."
"Something?"
Batman echoes, in that precise tone that means clarify. "I don't know," Tim answers, apologetic. "I didn't see anything. Maybe some kid threw a rock?" Batman grumbles, unsatisfied, then orders him back to the cave.
"You're on concussion protocol until Agent A can clear you. I'll go shake some trees, see if any delinquents with rocks fall out."
"Copy that," Tim says. He takes his bike back to the cave, where Alfred shines a penlight in his eyes, asks him who the president is, and then tuts over him until he agrees to stay overnight at the manor. Tim's room is sparsely populated, just a few extra clothes and some textbooks he brought over in the sixth grade and forgot to take home. He only ever stays over when he's sick or injured, but he can't deny that he feels safer here, down the hall from Bruce, with Alfred ducking in to wake him every hour than he would at home. Ever since those 7 months he spent in London, living out of Constantine's pocket and learning to speak to the dead, he hasn't been able to get back in the rhythm of being alone. Those vast echoing halls at Drake Manor, the drafts from the half of the house where the heat's never turned on, endless rooms with white sheets over pristine furniture. It reminds him too much of what it feels like to cross the veil, to brush up against the strange perpendicular winds of the other side. He doesn't sleep much when left to his own devices. Not until the sun's already coming up, the sky lightening outside, and an hour or so left before his alarm. That's okay, though. He's always had a nocturnal lifestyle. Gotham Academy had taken him back readily enough, with the recommendations of his alleged tutor, the completely fake Ms. Sweetwater. Tim still walks to the bus every morning, because while he might be able to drive the Batmobile well enough and operate his own motorcycle, 15 remains stubbornly below New Jersey's legal driving age. His parents phone periodically to make sure he's acing all his classes, and Tim can answer in the affirmative because he hacks the grades he doesn't get. He sits alone at lunch. He doesn't have time to make friends, since most of his energy goes into ignoring the fact that he can now feel the girl who OD'd in the second floor bathroom back in the 80s, and tries not to think about how everyone seems to like him so much better when they don't notice his existence. Case in point, he's sitting in the back of Calc AB, not existing, when an invisible force snaps his collarbone. The pain is so sharp and sudden that Tim's not even in control of his reaction. He lurches out of his desk, shoving all his books to the floor, and pukes on Missy Peterson's backpack. There's a lot of girlish shrieking and frantic administrative action after that, during which everyone's estimation of Tim seems to drop straight through the floor. He tries to make things up to Missy by offering, slightly deliriously, to hack her calc grade, which he knows is shit, but she's too offended by the correct implication that she's failing math to make the smart move and graciously accept. And by the time Tim's loaded into the back of the ambulance, the whole school has been informed via its very efficient grapevine that Tim Drake likes to puke on girls, like a sick sex thing or something. Tim's in too much pain to give a shit. He's had serious injuries before, broken bones on patrol, but somehow this is worse than every other time. Probably it's the shock of it more than anything. He wasn't doing anything that should have resulted in him getting hurt, just sitting in fucking math class. But it's like someone jammed a white-hot poker between his neck and his shoulder, and he can't draw a deep breath without an excruciating stab of pain. All he can do is lay there on the gurney and take these short, desperate swallows and feel like he's suffocating.
"Hey there, buddy. You need to breathe."
One of the EMTs gets in Tim's face, exaggerating her breathing as she tries to get Tim to match her. Then, after a moment, swears when he doesn't respond and says, "Okay, put him out." There's a pinch at Tim's elbow, a needle, the cold, fuzzy rush of a sedative, and then he's gone. While he's under, he hears things. Voices murmuring up from the bowels of the earth, like water bubbling out of an aquifer. Whispering hisses twisting like snakes, swirling around him, stinging the tips of his fingers and the shells of his ears, like still hot embers caught in a maelstrom, a storm of souls raging against him in the dark. He can't make out the words, but he recognizes the tongue, the same dialect of hell that he heard in that morgue in London, like dead clacking teeth in a skeleton's face, desiccated vocal cords screeching together, nails on a chalkboard. He tries to fight his way through them, back to awareness, but it's no use. Their claws rake him back down, dragging him deeper, deeper.
"Timothy Drake!"
booms a voice, below him and in him and all around him. It's an awful sound, like waking up in the middle of the night with a fever, knowing something terrible is going to happen before it does. The sharp twist in your chest when you get your hopes up, only to have them crushed.
"No,"
he tries to beg.
"No, please, you can't take me. Not yet, not yet."
But he can't speak.
"You are mine,"
Satan thunders, sibilant.
"You have made a pact. You must honor it."
"Not yet,"
Tim sobs, trapped in the fetal curl of his own mind.
"Not yet. Please, not yet."
"His wound shall be visited upon you,"
that awful voice recites, unyielding.
"You shall know death as he did. 5 years will you pass in my service. Honor the pact, or all you love will suffer."
"Please,"
Tim starts, then waits with a gasp. A spike of pain shoots down his collarbone, and he screws up his face in a wince, falling back against the pillows. There are hands on him in an instant, big and warm and familiar, holding him down gently as Dick's voice calls for a nurse, and footsteps rush down the hall, harried and urgent.
"Bruce," Tim sobs, too out of it to know better. "It hurts. It hurts."
Bruce hushes him, soothing sweaty hair out of his face.
"I know, Tim. I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. You're going to be okay, sweetheart. I promise."
Tim tightens his grip on Bruce's shirt, his fists clenched so hard they're shaking. He can feel himself about to pass out again, perched right on the ledge of pain and oblivion, but he's fucking terrified. He knows what's waiting for him down there, and he can't go back. He can't. He thought he'd have more time. He thought the 5 years would be coming out of the end of his life, not the middle. He's not ready to go.
"Don't let them put me under," he begs Bruce. "Please, don't give me anything. I need to stay awake."
"Okay," Bruce promises, voice oddly choked.
"It's okay, Tim. I promise. We're not going to give you anything. Just calm down. I need you to calm down. Breathe with me, all right? In and out. That's it."
Tim makes an effort to match his breathing to Bruce's, trying to get his heart rate to calm down. He knows if he can't do it himself, the nurse is going to step in and do it for him, no matter what Bruce has promised him. But there aren't many obstacles Robin can't surmount, especially with Batman's help. So he breathes through the rhythmic stabs of pain, focusing on Bruce's comforting warmth, the shield of him between Tim and the world, his hands cradling Tim's head, and the familiar scent of his cologne, the one he only puts on when he goes out as Bruce Wayne. He must have got the call when he was at work, after the school tried and failed to reach Tim's parents, must have come all the way across town from Wayne Enterprises just for Tim to freak out all over him like a total amateur. "Sorry," Tim says, once his heart's back at a normal rate. "Sorry, I'm sorry." The nurse is gone, apparently satisfied with his vital signs. Dick's hovering at the foot of the bed, one hand circling Tim's ankle through the blanket, and he makes a hurt sound at Tim's apology.
"Why? What are you sorry for?"
"You know," Tim waves his hand, still shaking, to encompass all this. "I didn't mean to interrupt your guys' day."
"Tim."
Bruce settles back to sit on the edge of the bed, weight dipping the mattress. He doesn't take his hand away from Tim's face, but he feels further away, and Tim forces down a nonsensical pang of hurt at that.
"I'll tell you this as many times as you need to hear it. You're not an inconvenience. We care about you."
Once, back in the early days after Jason's resurrection, when Tim had still been nursing a slight limp from the broken leg, he'd watched Jason force a gun under Batman's chin and snarl,
"I'll do it, old man. I swear I'll do it."
Daring his father to hurt him, to put him down. And Bruce had just held his hands out at his sides, open, and said,
"I love you."
Tim's never heard that from Bruce, not directed at him, and he's never going to. The most he's ever going to get is, "I care about you." And that's enough. It's enough. He just has to remind himself sometimes that it is. "I know," he says, swallowing hard. "Thanks, B." Bruce rustles his hair gently, then takes his hand away. Before Tim can linger too much on the feeling of being plunged into cold water, Dick draws his attention by squeezing his ankle. "So, baby bird, want to tell us what happened?"
"I don't know,"
Tim almost says, knee-jerk. But that's not quite true anymore, is it? He heard that voice in the dark, like magma, like molten rock given sentience, the meat of the earth raging up to collect what's due.
"His wounds shall be visited upon you."
Now that Tim thinks about it, that hit he took to the head the other night did feel kind of like a crowbar. "Gym class," he lies, fast enough that it earns him a skeptical look from Dick. The story won't hold up to scrutiny. All they have to do is talk to literally one other student from his math class, or the school nurse, or anyone. But Tim doesn't need it to. He just needs it to hold up long enough for him to wiggle out of this hospital situation and get an SOS out to Constantine. Time is, after all, of the essence. There's no telling how much longer Tim has before the next hit. Was it a shattered kneecap? A dislocated shoulder? A fractured cheekbone? What part of Jason did the Joker break next? And he knows what this is all leading up to. The big kaboom. The massive explosion that took Jason out for good, or at least for the 7 months before Tim managed to bring him back. There's no way Tim's going to have the wherewithal to maneuver out of the devil's clutches after he takes the psychic equivalent of a bomb to the face, so if he's going to figure something out, he has to do it now. Luckily, he's not concussed, so when Bruce steps out to handle some paperwork and Dick goes down to the cafeteria for food, they let him have his phone. Tim dials Constantine's number from memory, gets his voicemail.
"Don't feckin' leave a message, mate. I swear to God."
And says very quickly, because he can see Dick coming back in the window to the hall. "Hey, it's me, Tim Drake. Listen, I think I might have sold my soul to the devil for 5 years, which is not what I thought I was doing, but anyway, call me back, okay? Gotta go, bye." He hangs up just as Dick comes through the door, shoving his phone under the blankets. Judging by the look Dick gives him, he might overdo it with the innocent smile, but that's okay. Even if Dick did suspect something, the truth is probably too crazy to guess. Hopefully too crazy to guess. Assuming, of course, that Bruce doesn't have a tap on his phone. Tim spends the next few days feeling like a guillotine's hanging over his head, poised to fall at any moment. Miraculously, Bruce never looks into Tim's story. If he did, Tim's pretty sure he would have gotten some questions about his clavicle spontaneously snapping in the middle of calculus. But Tim's got plenty of other problems to deal with, i.e. his sudden and crippling fear of sleep, the impending promise of more broken bones, and the fact that Constantine's not returning his calls. Tim's left about 28 messages at this point. He had to hack the voicemail box yesterday and clear it so he could leave more. And it's true he hasn't talked to Constantine much since they parted ways, but he thought they were at least on the level of phone consult. Either way, in the face of radio silence from across the pond, Tim is forced to devise his own plan of attack. He digs up his old notebooks, with his big, embarrassing 10-year-old handwriting, and gets to work reviewing what he learned back then. What it comes down to, unfortunately, is rule number 6. Magic, once done, can never be undone. Tim doesn't think he can wriggle out of this. And what's more, he can't even afford to try. Not with Jason's life on the line. Bench though he might be, there's no real reason to not let Tim run comms. So he does, tag-teaming with Alfred while everyone else is on patrol. It's going on 1 in the morning, 4 days after his broken collarbone, 5 if you're pedantic, when Red Hood breaks off interrogating a guy to say,
"Well, shit, lost my grip."
"What?" Tim says flatly. "You were holding him over the side of a building, Hood."
"Were" being the operative word, you know, past tense. Now we sort of, you know, splat.
Tim's eyes feel like he's been rubbing them with sand. His blood has to be 90% caffeine at this point. He's been mainlining Monster and Red Bull trying to stay awake, has only managed a few fitful cat naps on the bus to and from school, and he wants a cigarette in an acute, miserable way he hasn't since he came back from England. Somehow, this is making him feel like he's about to cry. The exhaustion, he hopes. "We needed him to talk," he hisses, furious. "He knew where the missing kids are, Hood. It's already been more than 48 hours. Do you know what the fucking chances are of finding them now?"
"Of course I fucking know the chances,"
Jason snarls back. Tim slams back the rest of his kryptonite monster and stands, shoving back his chair. "I'm coming down," he says. "Stay right there, Hood. I swear to God." Then rips off his headset and marches down to the equipment lockers before Jason can remind him that he's bench. Getting into his Robin uniform is tricky with the figure eight sling, and with the ticking clock that is Alfred, due back for a shift change at any moment. So instead, Tim just pastes a domino on his face and roars out of the cave in his civvies, hunched low over the handlebars of his bike so he can steer with his immobilized forearm. It's January, and Gotham is black under a layer of thin, slick ice. Twice on the way across the bridge, Tim's bike almost goes out from under him, but he manages to keep control of it, winding through narrow alleys into shadier and shadier territory until he gets to Red Hood's last known location. Splat was the correct term to describe the dead human trafficker they've got on their hands, and Tim only hopes as he parks the bike and hops off it that there's enough of the guy left to talk to. If there's not, then he's going to have to follow him down, and he's not too keen on showing his face in hell right now, for obvious reasons. "Didn't the old man bench you?" Jason asks, as soon as Tim's close enough. "What B doesn't know won't hurt him," Tim grumbles. Jason whistles, in a look at this guy kind of way, but Tim ignores him, crouching before the body. Half the guy's head is cratered in, but his neck seems to have survived the worst of it, and his jaw's not broken. Theoretically, he should be able to speak. Whether he does or not is another question entirely. Tim holds out a hand. "Got a knife?" Hood, to his credit, doesn't ask questions, just slaps the switchblade down in Tim's hand. Tim flips it open, holding it awkwardly in his immobilized hand, and drags it across his good palm. "Hey, what the shit?" Jason exclaims, lunging to take the knife back. That's fine. Tim's done what he needed to do. What the hell are you doing, replacement? Tim stands, moving to straddle the body. I'm finding out where those kids are. You want to help me or not? Jesus fuck. Jason stares at him for a moment, inscrutable behind his domino, then snaps out of it. Of course I want to find the kids. I just don't know what the ever-loving hell you're doing. When he starts thrashing, Tim says, in no mood to explain, hold his mouth open. Then, before Jason can ask anything else, he squeezes his cut hand, sprinkling blood down over the corpse, and murmurs, borrowed life, until the mess that used to be a man grits out a sharp dental groan and starts to thrash below him, nearly enough to knock him over. Jason lets out a sharp grunt, like he's too surprised and disturbed and confused by what he's seeing to form actual words, but he does what Tim asked him to. He gets on his knees by the corpse's stir-fry head and wrestles his jaw open, working against rigor mortis until Tim has enough of an opening to lean over and spit in his mouth. When it starts talking in earthly language, it only has one thing to say. Don't send me back. Don't send me back. Heavily accented Slavic, something Eastern European. Tim doesn't know and doesn't care. Just plants a foot on the man's sternum, already broken ribs caving under the pressure of his weight, and leans down to growl. You tell me where those kids are. Maybe I won't send you back. Jason listens intently while the corpse speaks, razor focused on his mission, even with the necromancy sideshow. They're at the docks, unguarded. Apparently the traffickers lock them in at night and leave them. Jason steps away to call into Barbara, who will call into her father, and by the time he gets back, Tim is standing beside the corpse, trying to wrap his cut hand with his teeth. Jason takes the gauze from him, finishes the job without speaking. It's starting to snow. Tim's breath hangs in front of his face, and Jason is big and very warm, and abruptly, shockingly, all Tim wants is to burrow into him and have Jason hold him like he used to imagine he'd do when he dreamed they'd be brothers. Instead, he says, "Bum a smoke?" Jason raises an eyebrow, at two, but doesn't challenge him. Good thing. Tim took enough pictures of Robin smoking back in the day to know he'd be a hypocrite if he did. Tim holds the cigarette between his teeth and lets Jason light it for him, cupping his hands around the flame, then takes a drag and exhales, grimy warmth seeping into his fingers and toes. Him too, he says, with a nod to the corpse. It only takes Jason a second to figure out what he means. Then he goes over to Tim's bike, douses a bloody rag in the gas tank, comes back to rub it all over the half-headless, still-begging corpse, and lights it on fire. So, Tim says, while bones crackle and English devolves to the man's mother tongue, devolves to the language of the dead, and silence again. There might be a few things I didn't tell you guys. Yeah, Jason reads, hands on his hips. No shit, baby bird. Luckily, the devil chooses that moment to shove a crowbar through Tim's leg. Tim's knee gives out, and he lands hard on the pavement, mute with pain. It's a wet, sticky wound this time, like he's bleeding, and bleeding a lot. And when he looks down, the leg of his jeans is stuck to the contour of his leg, so he figures he's got it right. Ow, he says, once he manages to say anything at all. Jason's there next to him, hands tight on his shoulders. Robin, he's saying, what's happening? Nothing, Tim mumbles, lips and tongue clumsy with pain. He lets himself lean forward into Jason's hands, into his space. At this point, he figures it can't hurt. He's not going to be here much longer anyways. It's just a flesh wound. A flesh wound from what? Jason says. He sounds almost panicked. Crowbar, Tim says, then immediately regrets it when Jason sucks in a tight breath. Never mind, don't worry about it. Just give me a lift back to the manor, okay? I can ride a bike with one arm, but one leg might be pushing it. Fine, Jason hauls him up, taking pretty much all of his weight as Tim hops on one leg. Again, Tim lets himself indulge. A little physical contact for the road. But the second we've got you patched up, you're telling me what's actually going on. Tim estimates that it's going to take at least a half hour to get back to the cave and clean his wound. There's plenty of time to come up with a lie. Hopefully. Except, Tim doesn't have to think of a lie, because Lux smiles upon him again, this time in the form of an all-hands league summons that's waiting for them on the back computer when they make it back. Jason's of the opinion that all-hands doesn't include teenagers with broken clavicles and gushing leg wounds, but Tim points out that he'll just jump in the Zeta tube as soon as Jason's gone and follow him up. So if he's really worried about Tim's well-being, he should just take him up on the first trip and make sure he gets there without any further damage. Which makes Jason throw up his hands and exclaim, "You are getting on my nerves, replacement." At least if Jason's back to calling Tim replacement, he's not worried enough about his well-being to interrogate him. They cram into the Zeta tube together, Jason's arms locked around him like a boa constrictor. They're tight enough to irritate Tim's broken clavicle, but he's too pathetically grateful for the contact to mention it, so instead he tucks his face into the tough armor of Jason's shoulder and closes his eyes while they dematerialize into the beam. Tim's always enjoyed his infrequent visits to the Watchtower. When he walks the halls as Robin, flanking Bruce in the cowl and cape, Tim feels important, like he matters, like he's part of something bigger than himself, something good. Now, though, limping along with his arm around Jason's shoulders, he mostly just feels out of place. That feeling only intensifies when they walk into the meeting room, because the entire league is there, and they all fall silent as Jason and Tim enter. Batman's the first to recover.
"Robin,"
he says, at almost the exact same moment that a familiar voice barks, "Oi!" Constantine shoulders his way out of the huddle, squinting at Tim hard, the same way he always did back in the day, like he's trying to solve a puzzle with the sheer force of will.
"That you, Sprog?"
"You're not supposed to be able to recognize me with the mask on," Tim croaks.
Constantine snorts and doesn't dignify that with a response.
"You've washed up in the nick of time, you have," he says, ignoring how the rest of the league is looking at him like he's grown a second head. "I need someone to hold open the door."
Tim's heart drops into his stomach.
"Oh God, I hate holding open the door."
"Too feckin' bad, mate. You're the only one qualified to do it."
"Robin?"
Batman's eyes are somehow very earnest behind the mask.
"You know Constantine. You've worked with him before."
Tim knows that Bruce isn't his dad. He can't be, because Tim already has a dad, and even if he didn't, Bruce has never felt that way about him. But sometimes it's hard to remember. What he wants, more than anything, is to keel forward into Bruce's arms and confess everything. The deal he made, the wounds he suffered, that he tried to bring one of Bruce's real sons back and did it wrong. Batman solves problems. It's what he does. And Tim wants to let him solve this one, because honestly, he doesn't know how. He doesn't see a solution, at least not one that ends with him still on Earth. And it might have taken him a while to sprout that stubborn sapling of hope that all kids are supposed to have. The one that says your parents will always be there when you need them, that they can fix everything and anything. But it's here now. He feels it. He just can't afford to believe it.
"I kinda know him," he admits.
"Robin," Jason says, squeezing him painfully.
"You're not in any kind of shape to be holding open doors to the next dimension or whatever, man."
"It's fine," Tim insists. "I'm fine." But Bruce has zeroed in on his bloody leg, which they've really only managed to slap some gauze on before hopping in the Zeta tube. Tim probably left bloody footprints in the halls on the way here, which is like level 10 embarrassing. And Tim needs to execute a graceful escape before Batman manages to bench him again. Remind him that he's benched. Whatever.
"You,"
he points at Constantine.
I need to talk to you about this hell door, whatever, in private.
There's some general discontent over that proclamation, grumbling from the League, who feel, reasonably, that they should be kept in the loop on potential world-ending events, which this seems to be. A spluttered Heldor from Nightwing, who looks like he might need a bucket. Bruce, twitching, like he means to put himself between Tim and Constantine, before the sorcerer manages to swivel past him and steer Tim towards the door.
Right then, Poppet. Step into my office. Important business to discuss. Etc., etc., he mutters, until they're across the hall, into one of the private meeting rooms, where he snaps his fingers and all the cameras spark out at once. The lights spark out, too, leaving them in semi-darkness in the backup light, but Constantine barely seems to notice.
You might have mentioned you were Batman's feckin' kid, he accuses, to kick things off.
Tim slumps back against the wall, trying to take the weight off his injured leg.
I'm not, he says. I didn't even know him back then. I mean, I knew him, but only because he was my neighbor, and because one of his sons went to my school.
Constantine goes very still, watching him. Then he says,
Jason.
Tim nods.
You look like you've been through the bloody ringer, mate, Constantine says, like he's just now noticing.
Tim shrugs with his one shoulder that still works. It hurts, but the extra pain barely even registers. His whole body is one bright white light of agony. He wonders if he looked under his clothes, would he find more bruises? Maybe Satan's been getting hits in without him noticing.
I made a deal, he tells Constantine, resigned. Like you taught me. The same wounds that killed Jason and 5 years off my life. I thought I'd just die at 90 instead of 95. I didn't know he could take me in the middle.
Constantine doesn't say anything. It's unsettling. He's not a quiet man. Even his silence has noise normally. But now?
I'll hold the door for you, Tim says, avoiding his gaze.
Whether it's disappointment or pity on Constantine's face, he doesn't want to see it. I just don't think I'll be able to follow you back out once I show my face. After a minute, Constantine says,
It's important.
Tim exhales.
I know, he says, still not looking up. I know it's important.
There's a war brewing between heaven and hell, and that sort of thing tends not to end well for the realm in between. I sent spies ahead, scouts, but neither of them came back. And it's a lot easier to get someone back from the devil than it is to get them back from God.
I know, Tim says. I get it. You have to go get them.
None of my usual collaborators are available, Constantine continues. Zatanna swanned off to some dark dimension.
I said I get it, Tim interrupts, frustrated. This is what I signed on for. It's fine. It's only 5 years. I can handle it.
No, you can't, Constantine says. 5 years in hell, Sprague, and you're, what, 15?
So what if I am?
Listen. Constantine fixes him with the same look he used to give him when he was about to ask him to do something stupid and illegal, like steal holy water from a church, or steal silverware from the restaurant in the Bentley because they were running out, or mostly just steal stuff.
I've got an idea to get you out of this, but it might not work, so you should probably say some goodbyes just in case.
Tim's heart leaps like a frog into his throat.
Jason.
He'll be fine, mate. Just trust me, all right?
That's the same thing he used to say before all the stealing, too. Mandy was never wrong.
Okay, Tim says. But we better get a move on before the explosion.
Before the what? Constantine splutters.
Tim chooses Dick as the intermediary for his heartfelt goodbye slash confession, because he figures Dick is the nicest, and thus least likely to bite his head off about the whole thing. The choice backfires spectacularly, because Dick starts crying.
Hey, don't cry, Tim says,
patting Dick's head, sort of awkward. It's weird trying to comfort someone who's bigger than him. It's okay. I'm okay. Dick wraps his arms around Tim's thin waist and drags him into a hug, burying his salty face in Tim's shoulder. It's not okay. It's not okay, baby bird. Jesus. You traded years of your life for Jason, Tim says, bewildered. He doesn't know why Dick's so upset. Tim didn't even tell him the really bad stuff, like how it felt digging Jason up out of the ground before he did the blood magic to restore his body. The smell and the soft dead feeling of his skin, like paper dissolved in water. How it took Tim almost a year to stop having nightmares about how Jason's eyes look, milky and unseeing. What did you want me to do? Not bring him back? Anyway, it was just me. It was only me. That's a steal. Dick takes Tim's face in his hands, like Bruce did at the hospital. Thank you, Tim imagines he's about to say, like he and Bruce always say in his more indulgent dreams. I care about you, Tim, because you brought my brother back. Thank you. Timothy Jackson Drake, Dick says instead, intense and very close, holding his eyes like Tim's in trouble or something. You listen to me. You are not worth less than anyone else. I'm never going to be mad that Jason's back, but I'm sure as a hell going to be mad about how he got here, because he's not my only brother. What? Tim says, face sandwiched between Dick's hands, suddenly feeling much younger than 15. What? He says. Dick grumbles. You're my brother, stupid. Just as much as Jason. I love you. Tim's been doing a pretty good job, these last few days, of avoiding all the wetter emotions. Spite and anger and humor have gotten him far in life. He figured out early that there's not really any use crying when no one's around to hear, and when they wouldn't care even if they were. But here with his brother, it all rises up above him like a tidal wave, threatening to crash down, to crush him. All his terror, all his grief, his desperation and his yearning, every tiny hurt that he swept neatly into the dustpan and tried to forget, because he knew the alternative was leaving it shattered all over the floor where he'd have to clean it up later. It rears up behind him like some great beast, claws poised to kill. But it's not going to get him. Not now. Not while Dick's here. I love you too, he chokes out, and then he's back in Dick's arms, being held, being rocked gently, the way mothers rock their babies on television. Dick petting his hair, murmuring mindless words of comfort. Hey, you're okay. I've got you, baby bird. I've got you. Eventually, Tim has to extract himself. There is, after all, still a job to be done. Dick lets him go only with extreme reluctance, which is nice. Tim will hold that memory close to his heart for the next 5 years. Maybe it will be enough that he'll still be sane when it's all over. The League are all yelling at each other when they get back to the meeting room. Constantine props sullenly in the corner with his feet up on the table. Aquaman seems to be under the impression that he could hold the door open for Constantine through sheer force of will. Flash thinks he can get in and out before the devil notices he's even there. Clark thinks they're breaking a bunch of child labor laws, which is probably true, but it's not like Batman wasn't breaking them already anyways. Jason spots Tim and Dick as soon as they come back in the room. Tim only has a second to wonder if him being Dick's brother makes him Jason's brother, too, before Bruce follows his son's line of sight and breaks away from Clark to stride over to them. Robin, he starts. B, Tim interrupts before he can get going. I get that you're worried, okay? I'm scared too, but this has to get done. You know that. And Constantine's right. I'm the only one here who knows how to do it. Bruce stares down at him for a long moment, out of place in the bright lights of the watchtower. And Tim knows that Bruce knows he's right. He knows Bruce is going to let him do it, let him go, and it shouldn't hurt as much as it does, because it's what he expected.
What he doesn't expect is for Bruce to kneel at his feet.
Robin, he says again, patient, like he's way ahead of Tim, but doesn't mind waiting for him to catch up.
If you don't get back, I'm coming down after you. I promise.
That sapling sprout branches and shoots hard through Tim's chest, suddenly a full-grown tree.
Okay, Tim says. Okay, B. I believe you.
Bruce puts his hand on his face, thumb swiping the dried tracks of Tim's tears.
As touching as this all is,
Constantine pipes up behind them.
We are working with a clock here, mates.
Right, Tim says, hop-stepping away from Bruce. We're gonna need a cat, and not a tabby. Tim held the door open for Constantine a few times, back in London. It's not something that requires a whole lot of skill, but it does require training, so that when Constantine yells at you in total gibberish while running with several thousand demonic hellspawn in tow, you can interpret it quickly and follow his instructions so the world doesn't end. Mostly, it's like hanging over the side of a building with one hand, dangling above the never-ending abyss, so that Constantine can grab your hand on his way back up to the land of the living. In 1,000-degree heat, with 0% humidity, while half of your consciousness is still in your body, trying to keep a wet, angry cat from scratching your eyes out. It's Tim's least favorite of all the occult bitch jobs he's ever had to do, and it's all the worse this time because he's pretty sure that any second now, Satan's going to jump out and say, boo. To stay calm while he waits, Tim thinks of Bruce, his promise to follow Tim down if he doesn't come back. Tim doesn't doubt he would do it, and it's a comforting image to conjure. Batman, charging through the gates of hell, a demon himself in his cape and cowl, stone-faced and unyielding and backlit by the ravenous, ever-burning fires. When Tim has nightmares about this place, they're mostly about falling, about losing his grip, and dropping straight out of life and into hell. Nothing below him but heat and open air. And now, he imagines Bruce flying down after him, cape fluttering behind him like wings, hands reaching. More than anything in the world, Tim wants to go back to them. He wants to keep being Robin, keep the closest thing to a family he's ever had. But even if he can't, he thinks it was enough, just to have it for a while. When the devil breaks his ribs, he feels it in both bodies. The physical, back on the watchtower, and the spectral, in hell. He gasps, stuttering hard enough that he almost loses his grip on the ledge before he tightens and gets it back. In the meeting room, where he's half submerged in water and shaking like he's hypothermic, he squeezes the cat so hard it starts yowling. Vaguely, he can sense people gathering around him, snatches of Diana's accent, and Barry's rapid-fire intonation, the comforting rumble of Bruce's voice, and someone's fingers in his hair, soothing him. It hurts to breathe. He takes short, hitching swallows, fingers straining so hard that he's sure his knuckles are about to give way, and those same awful voices he heard before hiss around his feet like a pit of vipers, rising like blood in his ears.
Honor the pact! Honor the pact! Honor the pact!
No! Tim yells with both bodies. No, you can't have me.
Tim,
Bruce says, from very far away.
Tim, fight it. Come back to me.
Tim lets out a wordless scream of exertion, fighting to pull himself up, to hold onto the ledge. There are tears in his eyes, and something that stings, soot or smoke or blood, but he doesn't close them. He can't close them. Because if he does, then he knows he's finished.
Timothy Drake!
Satan booms, a voice from the sky, from the ground, from inside Tim's own bones.
Your debt is due!
No!
Tim yells, half sobbing, furious, desperate.
No, I won't go!
5 years of service. You are mine.
Something tears at Tim's legs, like phantom claws dragging him down, sinking into his flesh and scraping his bones. And Tim screams as he holds onto the ledge, digging his fingernails in so hard they start to peel off. But he won't. Constantine isn't back yet, so he can't let go. He can't let go. He can't. Oi, Sprog! The relief is so strong that Tim almost relaxes, but at the last second, his body remembers what a bad idea that is, and he holds on. About fucking time, he yells down as Constantine reaches the bottom of the gates and starts climbing. Shut it, you ungrateful twit. He reaches the ledge just below Tim and forces something in his hand instead of grabbing on. It's a rolled up piece of paper. Take this. Go back without me. I can't, Tim grits out through bared teeth. He's trying to take me. I can't. Lucifer, Constantine yells, turning out to face the burning plains and the smoke-dark skies. Suddenly, he's a man without a single shit to give, arms flung wide, balancing on the ledge by the very edges of his boot heels. Oh, I know you want me, you disgusting old hag. Well, now's your shot. 5 years of service. Let the kid go, and you can have me. Wait, Tim says, only feebly understanding what's going on. Wait, you can't... You never did learn manners, did you? Constantine interrupts, passing him a fond, end-of-the-world kind of look. When someone does you a favor, you're supposed to say thank you. Tears gush down Tim's face, totally out of his control. Thank you, he starts to say, but before he can finish, there's a peal of laughter. Like an earthquake, the roar of a hurricane, an indubitable force of nature. And the next thing he knows, he's gasping in a tub of water in the watchtower, shaking so badly he's sloshing it all over the floor and clutching a cat. The cat goes first, as soon as he has the presence of mind to let go of it, shooting into the hall as a streak of furious fur. Later, Tim won't remember the next few minutes, but he thinks he manages to get the note to someone, Clark probably, or Diana, because Bruce is too busy hauling Tim out of the water to deal with it. There are fluffy towels and a lot of arms around him. Bruce and Dick and Jason all gathered close, and for a while nothing hurts, and Tim thinks he's just numb, at least until Jason points out he's not bleeding anymore. The wound on his calf closed up like it was never even there. Somehow, they get back to the manor. Tim doesn't remember the ride through the Zeta tube, or leaving the cave, or who takes his domino off for him. The next thing he's aware of, he's sitting in Alfred's kitchen with a blanket wrapped around his shoulders, hair fluffy and dry, a mug of something steamy and chocolatey on the table in front of him, and he says, I don't deserve it. What? Jason says, sitting across from him. The hot cocoa? Tim shakes his head, tears falling anew. Constantine took my place. I don't deserve it. I don't. Shit. Jason breathes and slides around the booth to pull Tim into his arms. Tim doesn't have the energy left to worry if Jason is his brother, if it's going to weird him out for Tim to go boneless and get snot all over his shirt. It's too late for that now. And Jason doesn't seem to mind in the end. He rubs Tim's back and kisses the top of his head and says, You deserve it, baby bird. Shit, I'm the one who doesn't deserve it. That's quite enough of that, Alfred says, returning from the pantry. He sets up a platter of cookies on the table. Tim spots both his and Jason's favorite, and then drags up a chair to sit beside them. His eyes have always been kind, Tim thinks, but now there's something underneath that kindness, too. Something like steel. Boys, he says, serious. Love is not a game of debts and measures. I shall hear no more talk of deserving in this house. This family's been through quite the ordeal tonight, and I won't have it made worse by scrabbling around and trying to assign blame. He pins Tim with a look. Is that clear? Crystal, Tim rasps. His voice is hoarse from screaming. There are questions. Bruce treats it like a post-mission interview,
When he returns, red-eyed from changing out of his suit, still with awful cowl hair, but dressed in the sweats he keeps down in the cave.
"How do you know Constantine?"
he asks. "And how did you spend several months in London without your parents noticing? And why didn't you tell us?" Tim answers in as businesslike a manner as he can manage right now. "Just the facts, ma'am," ignoring the small, complicated emotions that flicker behind Bruce's eyes when he admits that his parents have only been home a month or so out of the past 5 years. The last question trips him up, though. There's no businesslike way to answer, so instead he just does his best to answer without breaking into tears. "I didn't want you to hate me," he admits, staring down at his knees. He doesn't want to say this, doesn't want them all to start looking at him like he's a monster, but he doesn't have it in him to lie to them anymore. It wouldn't be fair to lie to them anymore.
"Why would we hate you, baby bird?" Dick asks from the door.
Tim looks up at him. Dick has been crying again, Tim can tell. His eyelashes are clumped together like they're wet, dark spikes against his skin. He remembers Dick holding him and thinking it would be enough to last him 5 years, and resolves despite the pang in his chest to believe it's true. It's enough to live on. It's plenty.
"I brought him back wrong," he says, barely more than a whisper.
Jason tenses up behind him, but Tim barrels on. Now that he's started talking, it's all spilling out at once. "I did the best that I could, but I must have messed up something in his brain because he came back so angry." Everyone in the room bristles, all of them opening their mouths to say something at once. Alfred beats the rest to it.
"Master Tim," he says, "it is because of you that Master Jason returned to us at all, and for that, you deserve nothing more than our undying gratitude."
"I thought we weren't supposed to talk about deserve," Tim points out, but he feels warm. Alfred's eyes smile. "Besides," Jason says, jostling Tim where he's still got an arm around his shoulders, "I mostly just came back confused, not angry. You try spending 7 months in hell, see if your head's screwed on straight when it's over."
"No," Bruce says, looking ill. "No one's spending any more time in hell. My heart can't take it."
Dick squeezes his dad's shoulder. "Seconded. I think what we all need now is a good night's sleep." Tim hasn't slept more than an hour at a stretch in a few weeks, so sleep sounds like just the thing. He tries to head home, but none of the Waynes will hear of it, so instead he tries to go to his room, but none of them will hear of it that either. Jason and Dick loudly, and Bruce with a sort of sad, disapproving frown behind them. Tim gives up and asks them where they'd prefer him to sleep, since they're suddenly so picky about it, and then gets herded into Bruce's room, to the comically enormous Alaska King. Tim pauses in the doorway, the other three going on ahead of him. It's Bruce who notices Tim standing on the threshold like a vampire who hasn't been invited inside. Bruce, who comes back to him, concerned.
"What is it, buddy?"
"I can't," Tim starts, then stops, choked up. He knows Bruce and Dick do this sometimes after a bad patrol, an old habit from their days as Batman and Robin, when they were alone against the world. He's even caught Bruce holding Jason after a nightmare, braced behind him in bed while Jason thrashed and sobbed, the sort of thing that neither of them ever talked about in the morning. Like they could only afford to be father and son under cover of night. But Tim's not part of that. Tim's not Bruce's son. He looks at Bruce with wide eyes, hoping that Bruce can see what he means, what's keeping him on the threshold, that he doesn't make Tim say it. Bruce puts a hand on Tim's head, cupping the curve of his skull.
"I'll sleep better," he says, "with all my sons next to me."
Tim blinks rapidly. Suddenly, it's hard to draw breath. "I have nightmares," he protests, when his voice returns, but it sounds weak even to his own ears. "I'll wake you guys up." Bruce smiles, tired and fond.
"That's okay, sweetheart. That's the point."
Fed up with how long they're taking, Jason grabs Tim and throws him on the bed. Tim squawks indignantly, but then Dick is there with an arm around his waist, hugging him back snug against his chest, and Jason flops in next to them.
And Bruce lingers for a moment, standing beside the bed with this look on his face that some people get when they're looking at old pictures, like they're remembering a feeling they forgot they could feel. Then Jason reaches out and kicks him, grumbling, "Come on, old man." And Bruce climbs in next to them with the dramatic, beleaguered sigh of someone pretending to be older and less firm than they actually are, gathering the package deal of Tim and Dick into his arms as he settles back against the pillows. And Tim does have nightmares that night. He wakes up once with a stifled gasp, one with a cry, once in total silence with an infinitesimal twitch of the muscles, but each time he wakes to find himself not alone. Bruce kisses his forehead, and Dick reminds him that he's safe, that they're all safe. And Jason mutters, grumpy and half awake, his lips moving against the mess of Tim's hair, "Go back to sleep, motherfucker." And, surrounded by his family, Tim does. The end.
But don't hold to yourself. Would harden mortar and stone. Be a rubber band man. Make the water your bones. Dying just to live now. You're a world away, but you're still the same. I know you by your heart, and I will call you by your name.
Bloopers incoming.
Snoring obliviously. The dead aren't the only things that can get... oxidized green copper coins scattered among detached phalanges. Oxidized green copper coins scattered among detached phalanges. Staring unfocused out the windshield. God, read things normal, Cage. He pulls his sweatshirt. He sticks his door in the foot. Math, coding, criminal. Charges 71 human teeth. Human. Constantine slits his palm and squeezes blood onto a cold blue body at the morgue. I need to take a break. Like he does when they lose track of a particularly slippy vampire. Which includes teaching England's. Like they get when he's trying to work his way. Recognizes him. Asks him.
Ask him what you want to ask him, birthday boy. Boy?
And possibly cramming hors d'oeuvres in his face. Hors d'oeuvres? Isn't it hors d'oeuvres? That sounds so wrong. Hors d'oeuvres. Fudge. What am I doing with my brain right now? Oh my god, it's fucking hors d'oeuvres, dumbass. Thanks, brain. And that's hell of a... What? Worth? No. Worth a hell. Slowly, turning slowly, actually. I'll go to... The pain is so sharp and sudden that Tim's not even control... I hated all of that. And he can't draw more than a deep breath without the... That waffle. Don't fucking leave a message, mate. I swear to God. And says very quickly, because he can see... I swear to God. Sounds so southern. Kind of glad I messed up so I could hear that and fix it. So in Ted, he gets on his knees by the curbs, taking pretty much all of his weight as Tim. He mutters until they're across the hall in one of the private meeting rooms. Tim chooses Dick as the intermediary. Because he figures Dick is the nicest, and thus least likely to bite. Thank you, he starts to say, but he...